They had decided that a fictional foreigner was the safest cover for Ron to assume.
He speaks very little English, but he is in sympathy with the Dark Lord's aims. He has traveled here from Transylvania to see our new regime.
Indeed. How do you do, Dragomir?
How are you?
Said Ron, holding out his hand. Travers extended two fingers and shook Ron's hand as though frightened of dirtying himself.
So, what brings you and your, sympathetic friend to Diagon Alley this early? Asked Travers.
I need to visit Gringotts, said Hermione.
Alas, I also, said Travers. Gold, filthy gold. We cannot live without it, yet I confess I deplore the necessity of consorting with our long-fingered friends.
Harry felt Griphook's clasped hands tighten momentarily around his neck.
Shall we?
Said Travers, gesturing Hermione forward. Hermione had no choice but to fall into step beside him and head along the crooked cobbled street toward the place where the snowy white Gringotts stood towering over the other little shops. Ron sloped along beside them, and Harry and Griphook followed. A watchful Death Eater was the very last thing they needed, and the worst of it was, with Travers marching at what he believed to be Bellatrix's side, there was no means for Harry to communicate with Hermione or Ron. All too soon they arrived at the foot of the marble steps leading up to the great bronze doors. As Griphook had already warned them, the liveried goblins, who usually flanked the entrance, had been replaced by two wizards, both of whom were clutching long, thin, golden rods.
Ah, probity probes, sighed Travers theatrically. So crude, but effective.
And he set off up the steps, nodding left and right to the wizards, who raised the golden rods and passed them up and down his body. The probes, Harry knew, detected spells of concealment and hidden magical objects. Knowing that he had only seconds, Harry pointed Draco's wand at each of the guards in turn and murmured, "Confundo!" twice. Unnoticed by Travers, who was looking through the bronze doors at the inner hall, each of the guards gave a little start as the spells hit them. Hermione's long black hair rippled behind her as she climbed the steps.
"One moment, madam," said the guard, raising his probe.
"But you've just done that," said Hermione, in Bellatrix's commanding, arrogant voice.
Travers looked around, eyebrows raised. The guard was confused. He stared down at the thin golden probe, and then at his companion, who said in a slightly dazed voice,
"Yeah, you've just checked them, Marius."
Hermione swept forward, Ron by her side, Harry and Griphook trotting invisibly behind them. Harry glanced back as they crossed the threshold. The wizards were both scratching their heads. Two goblins stood before the inner doors, which were made of silver, and which carried the poem warning of dire retribution to potential thieves. Harry looked up at it, and all of a sudden a knife-sharp memory came to him. Standing on this very spot on the day that he had turned 11, the most wonderful birthday of his life, and Hagrid standing beside him saying,
"Like I said, you'd be mad to try and rob it."
Gringotts had seemed a place of wonder that day, the enchanted repository of a trove of gold he had never known he possessed, and never for an instant could he have dreamed that he would return to steal. But within seconds they were standing in the vast marble hall of the bank. The long counter was manned by goblins sitting on high stools, serving the first customers of the day. Hermione, Ron, and Travers headed toward an old goblin who was examining a thick gold coin through an eyeglass. Hermione allowed Travers to step ahead of her on the pretext of explaining features of the hall to Ron. The goblin tossed the coin he was holding aside, said to nobody in particular,
"Leprechaun,"
and then greeted Travers, who passed over a tiny golden key, which was examined and given back to him. Hermione stepped forward.
"Madame Lestrange,"
said the goblin, evidently startled.
"Dear me, how may I help you today?"
"I wish to enter my vault," said Hermione.
The old goblin seemed to recoil a little. Harry glanced around. Not only was Travers hanging back, watching, but several other goblins had looked up from their work to stare at Hermione.
"You have identification?"
asked the goblin.
"Identification? I have never been asked for identification before," said Hermione.
"They know,"
whispered Griphook in Harry's ear.
"They must have been warned there might be an impostor." "Your wand will do, madam,"
said the goblin. He held out a slightly trembling hand, and in a dreadful blast of realization, Harry knew that the goblins of Gringotts were aware that Bellatrix's wand had been stolen.
"Act now, act now,"
whispered Griphook in Harry's ear.
"The imperious curse."
Harry raised the hawthorn wand beneath the cloak, pointed it at the old goblin, and whispered for the first time in his life, "Imperio." A curious sensation shot down Harry's arm, a feeling of tingling warmth that seemed to flow from his mind, down the sinews and veins connecting him to the wand and the curse it had just cast. The goblin took Bellatrix's wand, examined it closely, and then said,
"Ah, you have had a new wand made, Madame Lestrange."
"What?" said Hermione. "No, no, that's mine."
"A new wand?"
said Travers, approaching the counter again. Still the goblins all around were watching.
"But how could you have done? Which wand-maker did you use?"
Harry acted without thinking. Pointing his wand at Travers, he muttered,
"Imperio,"
once more.
"Oh, yes, I see,"
said Travers, looking down at Bellatrix's wand.
"Yes, very handsome. And is it working well? I always think wands require a little breaking in, don't you?"
Hermione looked utterly bewildered, but to Harry's enormous relief, she accepted the bizarre turn of events without comment. The old goblin behind the counter clapped his hands, and a younger goblin approached.
"I shall need the clankers,"
he told the goblin, who dashed away and returned a moment later with a leather bag that seemed to be full of jangling metal, which he handed to his senior.
"Good, good. So, if you will follow me, Madame Lestrange,"
said the old goblin, hopping down off his stool and vanishing from sight,
"I shall take you to your vault."
He appeared around the end of the counter, jogging happily toward them, the contents of the leather bag still jingling. Travers was now standing quite still with his mouth hanging wide open. Ron was drawing attention to this odd phenomenon by regarding Travers with confusion.
"Wait, Bugrud."
Another goblin came scurrying around the counter.
"We have instructions,"
he said with a bow to Hermione.
"Forgive me, madam, but there have been special orders regarding the vault of Lestrange."
He whispered urgently in Bogrod's ear, but the imperious goblin shook him off.
"I am aware of the instructions. Madame Lestrange wishes to visit her vault. Very old family, old clients. This way, please."
And, still clanking, he hurried toward one of the many doors leading off the hall. Harry looked back at Travers, who was still rooted to the spot, looking abnormally vacant, and made his decision. With a flick of his wand, he made Travers come with them, walking meekly in their wake as they reached the door and passed into the rough stone passageway beyond, which was lit with flaming torches.
"We're in trouble, they suspect,"
said Harry as the door slammed behind them and he pulled off the invisibility cloak. Griphook jumped down from his shoulders. Neither Travers nor Bogrod showed the slightest surprise at the sudden appearance of Harry Potter in their midst.
"They're imperious,"
he added, in response to Hermione and Ron's confused queries about Travers and Bogrod, who were both now standing there looking blank.
"I don't think I did it strongly enough. I don't know."
And another memory darted through his mind, of the real Bellatrix Lestrange, shrieking at him when he had first tried to use an unforgivable curse.
You need to mean them, Potter. What do we do?
Asked Ron. Shall we get out now while we can?
If we can,
said Hermione, looking back toward the door into the main hall, beyond which who knew what was happening. We've got this far. I say we go on, said Harry.
Good,
said Griphook.
So we need Bogrod to control the cart. I no longer have the authority, but there will not be room for the wizard.
Harry pointed his wand at Travers.
Imperio!
The wizard turned and set off along the dark track at a smart pace.
What are you making him do?
Hide, said Harry, as he pointed his wand at Bogrod, who whistled to summon a little cart that came trundling along the tracks toward them out of the darkness. Harry was sure he could hear shouting behind them in the main hall as they all clambered into it. Bogrod in front with Griphook, Harry, Ron and Hermione crammed together in the back. With a jerk, the cart moved off, gathering speed. They hurtled past Travers, who was wriggling into a crack in the wall. Then the cart began twisting and turning through the labyrinthine passages, sloping downward all the time. Harry could not hear anything over the rattling of the cart on the tracks. His hair flew behind him as they swerved between stalactites, flying even deeper into the earth, but he kept glancing back. They might as well have left enormous footprints behind them. The more he thought about it, the more foolish it seemed to have disguised Hermione as Bellatrix, to have brought along Bellatrix's wand when the Death Eaters knew who had stolen it. They were deeper than Harry had ever penetrated within Gringotts. They took a hairpin bend at speed and saw ahead of them, with seconds to spare, a waterfall pounding over the track. Harry heard Griphook shout,
"No!"
But there was no breaking. They zoomed through it. Water filled Harry's eyes and mouth. He could not see or breathe. Then, with an awful lurch, the cart flipped over, and they were all thrown out of it. Harry heard the cart smash into pieces against the passage wall, heard Hermione shriek something, and felt himself glide back toward the ground as though weightless, landing painlessly on the rocky passage floor.
"Cushioning charm,"
Hermione spluttered as Ron pulled her to her feet. But to Harry's horror, he saw that she was no longer Bellatrix. Instead, she stood there in over-large robes, sopping wet and completely herself. Ron was red-haired and beardless again. They were realizing it as they looked at each other, feeling their own faces.
"The thief's downfall," said Griphook,
clambering to his feet and looking back at the deluge onto the tracks, which, Harry knew now, had been more than water.
"It washes away all enchantment, all magical concealment. They know there are impostors in Gringotts. They have set off defenses against us."
Harry saw Hermione checking that she still had the beaded bag, and hurriedly thrust his own hand under his jacket to make sure he had not lost the invisibility cloak. Then he turned to see Bogrod shaking his head in bewilderment. The thief's downfall seemed to have lifted the imperious curse.
"We need him,"
said Griphook.
"We cannot enter the vault without a Gringotts goblin, and we need the clankers."
"Imperio," Harry said again. His voice echoed through the stone passage as he felt again the sense of heady control that flowed from brain to wand. Bogrod submitted once more to his will, his befuddled expression changing to one of polite indifference as Ron hurried to pick up the leather bag of metal tools.
"Harry, I think I can hear people coming,"
said Hermione, and she pointed Bellatrix's wand at the waterfall and cried,
"Protego!"
They saw the shield charm break the flow of enchanted water as it flew up the passageway.
"Good thinking," said Harry. "Lead the way, Griphook." "How are we going to get out again?"
Ron asked, as they hurried on foot into the darkness after the goblin, Bogrod panting in their wake like an old dog. "Let's worry about that when we have to," said Harry. He was trying to listen. He thought he could hear something clanking and moving around nearby. "Griphook, how much farther?"
"Not far, Harry Potter, not far."
And they turned a corner and saw the thing for which Harry had been prepared, but which still brought all of them to a halt. A gigantic dragon was tethered to the ground in front of them, barring access to four or five of the deepest vaults in the place. The beast's scales had turned pale and flaky during its long incarceration under the ground. Its eyes were milkily pink. Both rear legs bore heavy cuffs, from which chains led to enormous pegs driven deep into the rocky floor. Its great spiked wings, folded close to its body, would have filled the chamber if it spread them. And when it turned its ugly head toward them, it roared with a noise that made the rock tremble, opened its mouth, and spat a jet of fire that sent them running back up the passageway.
"It is partially blind,"
panted Griphook,
"but even more savage for that. However, we have the means to control it. It has learned what to expect when the clankers come. Give them to me."
Ron passed the bag to Griphook, and the goblin pulled out a number of small metal instruments that, when shaken, made a loud ringing noise like miniature hammers on anvils. Griphook handed them out. Bogrod accepted his meekly.
"You know what to do,"
Griphook told Harry, Ron, and Hermione.
"It will expect pain when it hears the noise. It will retreat, and Bogrod must place his palm upon the door of the vault."
They advanced around the corner again, shaking the clankers, and the noise echoed off the rocky walls, grossly magnified so that the inside of Harry's skull seemed to vibrate with the din. The dragon let out another hoarse roar, then retreated. Harry could see it trembling, and as they drew nearer, he saw the scars made by vicious slashes across its face, and guessed that it had been taught to fear hot swords when it heard the sound of the clankers.
"Make him press his hand to the door,"
Griphook urged Harry, who turned his wand again upon Bogrod. The old goblin obeyed, pressing his palm to the wood, and the door of the vault melted away to reveal a cave-like opening, crammed from floor to ceiling with golden coins and goblets, silver armor, the skins of strange creatures, some with long spines, others with drooping wings, potions in jeweled flasks, and a skull still wearing a crown. "Search fast," said Harry, as they all hurried inside the vault. He had described Hufflepuff's cup to Ron and Hermione, but if it was the other unknown Horcrux that resided in this vault, he did not know what it looked like. He barely had time to glance around, however, before there was a muffled clunk from behind them. The door had reappeared, sealing them inside the vault, and they were plunged into total darkness.
"No matter, Bogrod will be able to release us,"
said Griphook, as Ron gave a shout of surprise.
"Light your wands, can't you? And hurry, we have very little time."
"Lumos!"
Harry shone his lit wand around the vault. Its beam fell upon glittering jewels. He saw the fake sword of Gryffindor lying on a high shelf amongst a jumble of chains. Ron and Hermione had lit their wands too, and were now examining the piles of objects surrounding them.
"Harry, could this be—"
"Ah!"
Hermione screamed in pain, and Harry turned his wand on her in time to see a jeweled goblet tumbling from her grip. But as it fell, it split, became a shower of goblets, so that a second later, with a great clatter, the floor was covered in identical cups, rolling in every direction, the original impossible to discern amongst them.
"It burned me,"
moaned Hermione, sucking her blistered fingers.
"They have added Gemino and Flagrante curses," said Griphook. "Everything you touch will burn and multiply, but the copies are worthless, and if you continue to handle the treasure, you will eventually be crushed to death by the weight of expanding gold."
"Okay, don't touch anything," said Harry desperately.
But even as he said it, Ron accidentally nudged one of the fallen goblets with his foot, and 20 more exploded into being, while Ron hopped on the spot, part of his shoe burned away by contact with the hot metal.
"Stand still. Don't move," said Hermione, clutching at Ron.
"Just look around," said Harry. "Remember, the cup's small and gold. It's got a badger engraved on it, two handles. Otherwise, see if you can spot Ravenclaw's symbol anywhere. The eagle." They directed their wands into every nook and crevice, turning cautiously on the spot. It was impossible not to brush up against anything. Harry sent a great cascade of fake galleons onto the ground, where they joined the goblets. And now there was scarcely room to place their feet, and the glowing gold blazed with heat, so that the vault felt like a furnace. Harry's wand light passed over shields and goblin-made helmets set on shelves rising to the ceiling. Higher and higher he raised the beam, until suddenly it found an object that made his heart skip and his hand tremble.
It's there! It's up there!
Ron and Hermione pointed their wands at it too, so that the little golden cup sparkled in a three-way spotlight. The cup that had belonged to Helga Hufflepuff, which had passed into the possession of Hepzibah Smith, from whom it had been stolen by Tom Riddle.
"And how the hell are we going to get up there without touching anything?" asked Ron. "That's the old cup,"
cried Hermione, who had evidently forgotten in her desperation what Griphook had told them during their planning sessions.
"No use, no use," snarled the goblin.
"Then what do we do?" said Harry, glaring at the goblin. "If you want the sword, Griphook, then you'll have to help us more than... Wait. Can I touch stuff with the sword?"
"Hermione, give it here."
Hermione fumbled inside her robes, drew out the beaded bag, rummaged for a few seconds, then removed the shining sword. Harry seized it by its rubied hilt and touched the tip of the blade to a silver flagon nearby, which did not multiply.
"If I can just poke the sword through a handle, but how am I going to get up there?"
The shelf on which the cup reposed was out of reach for any of them, even Ron, who was tallest. The heat from the enchanted treasure rose in waves, and sweat ran down Harry's face and back as he struggled to think of a way up to the cup. And then he heard the dragon roar on the other side of the vault door, and the sound of clanking growing louder and louder. They were truly trapped now. There was no way out except through the door, and a horde of goblins seemed to be approaching on the other side. Harry looked at Ron and Hermione and saw terror in their faces.
"Hermione," said Harry as the clanking grew louder, "I've got to get up there. We've got to get rid of it."
She raised her wand, pointed it at Harry and whispered,
"Levicorpus."
Hoisted into the air by his ankle, Harry hit a suit of armor, and replicas burst out of it like white-hot bodies, filling the cramped space. With screams of pain, Ron, Hermione, and the two goblins were knocked aside into other objects, which also began to replicate. Half buried in a rising tide of red-hot treasure, they struggled and yelled as Harry thrust the sword through the handle of Hufflepuff's cup, hooking it onto the blade.
"Impervious!"
screeched Hermione in an attempt to protect herself, Ron, and the goblins from the burning metal. Then the worst scream yet made Harry look down. Ron and Hermione were waist-deep in treasure, struggling to keep Bogrod from slipping beneath the rising tide, but Griphook had sunk out of sight, and nothing but the tips of a few long fingers were left in view. Harry seized Griphook's fingers and pulled. The blistered goblin emerged by degrees, howling.
"Liberacorpus!"
yelled Harry, and with a crash, he and Griphook landed on the surface of the swelling treasure, and the sword flew out of Harry's hand.
"Get it!"
Harry yelled, fighting the pain of the hot metal on his skin as Griphook clambered onto his shoulders again, determined to avoid the swelling mass of red-hot objects.
"Where's the sword? It had the cup on it!"
The clanking on the other side of the door was growing deafening. It was too late.
"There!"
It was Griphook who had seen it, and Griphook who lunged. And, in that instant, Harry knew that the goblin had never expected them to keep their word. One hand holding tightly to a fistful of Harry's hair to make sure he did not fall into the heaving sea of burning gold, Griphook seized the hilt of the sword and swung it high out of Harry's reach. The tiny golden cup, skewered by the handle on the sword's blade, was flung into the air. The goblin still astride him, Harry dived and caught it. And although he could feel it scalding his flesh, he did not relinquish it, even while countless Hufflepuff cups burst from his fist, raining down upon him as the entrance of the vault opened up again, and he found himself sliding uncontrollably on an expanding avalanche of fiery gold and silver that bore him, Ron, and Hermione into the outer chamber. Hardly aware of the pain from the burns covering his body, and still borne along on the swell of replicating treasure, Harry shoved the cup into his pocket, and reached up to retrieve the sword. but Griphook was gone. Sliding from Harry's shoulders the moment he could, he had sprinted for cover amongst the surrounding goblins, brandishing the sword and crying,
"Thieves! Thieves! Help! Thieves!"
He vanished into the midst of the advancing crowd, all of whom were holding daggers and who accepted him without question. Slipping on the hot metal, Harry struggled to his feet and knew that the only way out was through.
"Stupefy!"
he bellowed, and Ron and Hermione joined in. Jets of red light flew into the crowd of goblins, and some toppled over, but others advanced, and Harry saw several wizard guards running around the corner. The tethered dragon let out a roar, and a gush of flame flew over the goblins. The wizards fled, doubled up, back the way they had come, and inspiration or madness came to Harry. Pointing his wand at the thick cuffs chaining the beast to the floor, he yelled,
"Relatio!"
The cuffs broke open with loud bangs.
"This way!"
Harry yelled, and still shooting stunning spells at the advancing goblins, he sprinted toward the blind dragon.
"Harry! Harry! What are you doing?"
cried Hermione.
"Get up! Climb up! Come on!"
The dragon had not realized that it was free. Harry's foot found the crook of its hind leg, and he pulled himself up onto its back. The scales were hard as steel. It did not even seem to feel him. He stretched out an arm. Hermione hoisted herself up. Ron climbed on behind them, and a second later the dragon became aware that it was untethered. With a roar, it reared. Harry dug in his knees, clutching as tightly as he could to the jagged scales as the wings opened, knocking the shrieking goblins aside like skittles, and it soared into the air. Harry, Ron, and Hermione, flat on its back, scraped against the ceiling as it dived toward the passage opening, while the pursuing goblins hurled daggers that glanced off its flanks.
"We'll never get out! It's too big!"
Hermione screamed, but the dragon opened its mouth and belched flame again, blasting the tunnel, whose floors and ceiling cracked and crumbled. By sheer force, the dragon clawed and fought its way through. Harry's eyes were shut tight against the heat and dust. Deafened by the crashing of rock and the dragon's roars, he could only cling to its back, expecting to be shaken off at any moment. Then he heard Hermione yelling,
"Deifodio!"
She was helping the dragon enlarge the passageway, carving out the ceiling as it struggled upward toward the fresher air, away from the shrieking and clanking goblins. Harry and Ron copied her, blasting the ceiling apart with more gouging spells. They passed the underground lake, and the great crawling, snarling beast seemed to sense freedom and space ahead of it. And behind them, the passage was full of the dragon's thrashing, spiked tail, of great lumps of rock, gigantic fractured stalactites, and the clanking of the goblins seemed to be growing more muffled, while ahead, the dragon's fire kept their progress clear. And then, at last, by the combined force of their spells and the dragon's brute strength, they had blasted their way out of the passage into the marble hallway. Goblins and wizards shrieked and ran for cover, and finally the dragon had room to stretch its wings. Turning its horned head toward the cool outside air it could smell beyond the entrance, it took off, and with Harry, Ron, and Hermione still clinging to its back, it forced its way through the metal doors, leaving them buckled and hanging from their hinges, as it staggered into Diagon Alley and launched itself into the sky. Chapter 27 The Final Hiding Place. There was no means of steering. The dragon could not see where it was going, and Harry knew that if it turned sharply or rolled in midair, they would find it impossible to cling onto its broad back. Nevertheless, as they climbed higher and higher, London unfurling below them like a grey and green map, Harry's overwhelming feeling was of gratitude for an escape that had seemed impossible. Crouching low over the beast's neck, he clung tight to the metallic scales, and the cool breeze was soothing on his burned and blistered skin, the dragon's wings beating the air like the sails of a windmill. Behind him, whether from delight or fear, he could not tell, Ron kept swearing at the top of his voice, and Hermione seemed to be sobbing. After 5 minutes or so, Harry lost some of his immediate dread that the dragon was going to throw them off, for it seemed intent on nothing but getting as far away from its underground prison as possible.
but the question of how and when they were to dismount remained rather frightening. He had no idea how long dragons could fly without landing, nor how this particular dragon, which could barely see, would locate a good place to put down. He glanced around constantly, imagining that he could feel his scar prickling. How long would it be before Voldemort knew that they had broken into the Lestrange's vault? How soon would the goblins of Gringotts notify Bellatrix? How quickly would they realize what had been taken? And then, when they discovered that the golden cup was missing, Voldemort would know at last that they were hunting Horcruxes. The dragons seemed to crave cooler and fresher air. It climbed steadily until they were flying through wisps of chilly cloud, and Harry could no longer make out the little coloured dots which were cars pouring in and out of the capital. On and on they flew, over countryside parcelled out in patches of green and brown, over roads and rivers winding through the landscape like strips of mat and glossy ribbon.
"What do you reckon it's looking for?"
Ron yelled as they flew farther and farther north.
"No idea,"
Harry bellowed back. His hands were numb with cold, but he did not dare attempt to shift his grip. He had been wondering for some time what they would do if they saw the coast sail beneath them, if the dragon headed for open sea. He was cold and numb, not to mention desperately hungry and thirsty. When, he wondered, had the beast itself last eaten? Surely it would need sustenance before long. And what if, at that point, it realized it had three highly edible humans sitting on its back? The sun slipped lower in the sky, which was turning indigo, and still the dragon flew, cities and towns gliding out of sight beneath them, its enormous shadow sliding over the earth like a great dark cloud. Every part of Harry ached with the effort of holding on to the dragon's back.
"Is it my imagination?"
shouted Ron after a considerable stretch of silence.
"Or are we losing height?"
Harry looked down and saw deep green mountains and lakes, coppery in the sunset. The landscape seemed to grow larger and more detailed as he squinted over the side of the dragon, and he wondered whether it had divined the presence of fresh water by the flashes of reflected sunlight. Lower and lower the dragon flew in great spiraling circles, honing in, it seemed, upon one of the smaller lakes.
"I say we jump when it gets low enough," Harry called back to the others. "Straight into the water before it realizes we're here."
They agreed, Hermione a little faintly, and now Harry could see the dragon's wide yellow underbelly rippling in the surface of the water.
"Now!"
He slithered over the side of the dragon and plummeted feet first toward the surface of the lake. The drop was greater than he had estimated, and he hit the water hard, plunging like a stone into a freezing green, reed-filled world. He kicked toward the surface and emerged panting to see enormous ripples emanating in circles from the places where Ron and Hermione had fallen. The dragon did not seem to have noticed anything. It was already 50 feet away, swooping low over the lake to scoop up water in its scarred snout. As Ron and Hermione emerged, spluttering and gasping from the depths of the lake, the dragon flew on, its wings beating hard, and landed at last on a distant bank. Harry, Ron, and Hermione struck out for the opposite shore. The lake did not seem to be deep. Soon it was more a question of fighting their way through reeds and mud than swimming, and at last they flopped, sodden, panting and exhausted, onto slippery grass. Hermione collapsed, coughing and shuddering. Though Harry could have happily lain down and slept, he staggered to his feet, drew out his wand, and started casting the usual protective spells around them. When he had finished, he joined the others. It was the first time that he had seen them properly since escaping from the vault. Both had angry red burns all over their faces and arms, and their clothing was singed away in places. They were wincing as they dabbed essence of Dittany onto their many injuries. Hermione handed Harry the bottle, then pulled out 3 bottles of pumpkin juice she had brought from Shell Cottage and clean, dry robes for all of them. They changed and then gulped down the juice.
"Well, on the upside," said Ron finally, who was sitting watching the skin on his hands regrow, "we got the Horcrux. On the downside..."
"No sword," said Harry through gritted teeth, as he dripped Dittany through the singed hole in his jeans onto the angry burn beneath.
"No sword," repeated Ron. That double-crossing little scab!
Harry pulled the Horcrux from the pocket of the wet jacket he had just taken off and set it down on the grass in front of them. Glinting in the sun, it drew their eyes as they swigged their bottles of juice.
At least we can't wear it this time. That'd look a bit weird hanging round our necks, said Ron, wiping his mouth on the back of his hand.
Hermione looked across the lake to the far bank, where the dragon was still drinking.
What'll happen to it, do you think?
She asked.
Will it be all right?
You sound like Hagrid, said Ron.
It's a dragon, Hermione. It can look after itself. It's us we need to worry about.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't know how to break this to you, said Ron, but I think they might have noticed we broke into Gringotts.
All three of them started to laugh, and once started, it was difficult to stop. Harry's ribs ached. He felt lightheaded with hunger, but he lay back on the grass beneath the reddening sky and laughed until his throat was raw.
What are we going to do, though?
said Hermione finally, hiccuping herself back to seriousness.
He'll know, won't he? You know who will know we know about his Horcruxes.
Maybe they'll be too scared to tell him, said Ron hopefully.
Maybe they'll cover up.
The sky, the smell of lake water, the sound of Ron's voice were extinguished. Pain cleaved Harry's head like a sword stroke. He was standing in a dimly lit room, and a semicircle of wizards faced him, and on the floor at his feet knelt a small, quaking figure.
What did you say to me?
His voice was high and cold, but fury and fear burned inside him. The one thing he had dreaded, but it could not be true. He could not see how. The goblin was trembling, unable to meet the red eyes high above his.
Say it again,
murmured Voldemort.
Say it again.
But my lord,
stammered the goblin, its black eyes wide with terror.
But my lord, we tried to stop them. Imposters, my lord. Broke into the Lestrange's vault.
Imposters? What imposters? I thought Gringotts had ways of revealing imposters. Who were they?
It was the Potter boy and two accomplices.
And they took,
he said, his voice rising, a terrible fear gripping him.
Tell me, what did they take?
A small golden cup, my lord.
The scream of rage, of denial, left him as if it were a stranger's. He was crazed, frenzied. It could not be true. It was impossible. Nobody had ever known. How was it possible that the boy could have discovered his secret? The Elder Wand slashed through the air, and green light erupted through the room. The kneeling goblin rolled over, dead. The watching wizards scattered before him, terrified. Bellatrix and Lucius Malfoy threw others behind them in their race for the door, and again his wand fell, and those who were left were slain, all of them, for bringing him this news, for hearing about the golden cup. Alone amongst the dead, he stormed up and down, and they passed before him in vision. His treasures, his safeguards, his anchors to immortality. The diary was destroyed and the cup was stolen. What if the boy knew about the others? Could he know? Had he already acted? Had he traced more of them? Was Dumbledore at the root of this? Dumbledore, who had always suspected him. Dumbledore, dead on his orders. Dumbledore, whose wand was his now. Yet who reached out from the ignominy of death through the boy?
The boy!
But surely if the boy had destroyed any of his Horcruxes, he, Lord Voldemort, would have known, would have felt it. He, the greatest wizard of them all, he, the most powerful, he, the killer of Dumbledore and of how many other worthless, nameless men. How could Lord Voldemort not have known if he, himself, most important and precious, had been attacked, mutilated? True, he had not felt it when the diary had been destroyed.
but he had thought that was because he had no body to feel, being less than ghost. No, surely the rest were safe. The other Horcruxes must be intact. But he must know. He must be sure. He paced the room, kicking aside the goblin's corpse as he passed, and the pictures blurred and burned in his boiling brain. The lake, the shack, and Hogwarts. A modicum of calm cooled his rage now. How could the boy know that he had hidden the ring in the Gaunt shack? No one had ever known him to be related to the Gaunts. He had hidden the connection. The killings had never been traced to him. The ring, surely, was safe. And how could the boy, or anybody else, know about the cave, or penetrate its protection? The idea of the locket being stolen was absurd. As for the school, he alone knew where, in Hogwarts, he had stowed the Horcrux, because he alone had plumbed the deepest secrets of that place. And there was still Nagini, who must remain close now, no longer sent to do his bidding, under his protection. But to be sure, to be utterly sure, he must return to each of his hiding places. He must redouble protection around each of his Horcruxes, a job like the quest for the Elder Wand that he must undertake alone. Which should he visit first? Which was in most danger? An old unease flickered inside him. Dumbledore had known his middle name. Dumbledore might have made the connection with the Gaunts. Their abandoned home was perhaps the least secure of his hiding places. It was there that he would go first. The lake, surely impossible, though there was a slight possibility that Dumbledore might have known some of his past misdeeds through the orphanage. And Hogwarts. But he knew that his Horcrux there was safe. It would be impossible for Potter to enter Hogsmeade without detection, let alone the school. Nevertheless, it would be prudent to alert Snape to the fact that the boy might try to re-enter the castle. To tell Snape why the boy might return would be foolish, of course. It had been a grave mistake to trust Bellatrix and Malfoy. Didn't their stupidity and carelessness prove how unwise it was ever to trust? He would visit the Gaunt shack first, then, and take Nagini with him. He would not be parted from the snake any more. And he strode from the room, through the hall, and out into the dark garden, where the fountain played. He called the snake in parcel tongue, and it slithered out to join him, like a long shadow. Harry's eyes flew open as he wrenched himself back to the present. He was lying on the bank of the lake in the setting sun, and Ron and Hermione were looking down at him. Judging by their worried looks and by the continued pounding of his scar, his sudden excursion into Voldemort's mind had not passed unnoticed. He struggled up, shivering, vaguely surprised that he was still wet to his skin, and saw the cup lying innocently in the grass before him, and the lake, deep blue, shot with gold in the failing sun. He knows. His own voice sounded strange and low after Voldemort's high screams. He knows, and he's going to check where the others are. And the last one, he was already on his feet, is at Hogwarts. I knew it! I knew it! What? Ron was gaping at him. Hermione sat up, looking worried. But what did you see? How do you know? I saw him find out about the cup. I was in his head. Harry remembered the killings. He's seriously angry, and scared, too. He can't understand how we knew. And now he's going to check the others are safe, the ring first. He thinks the Hogwarts one is safest, because Snape's there. Because it'll be so hard not to be seen getting in, I think he'll check that one last. But he could still be there within hours. Did you see where in Hogwarts it is? Asked Ron, now scrambling to his feet, too. No. He was concentrating on warning Snape. He didn't think about exactly where it is. Wait, wait, cried Hermione as Ron caught up the Horcrux and Harry pulled out the invisibility cloak again. We can't just go. We haven't got a plan. We need to get going, said Harry firmly. He had been hoping to sleep, looking forward to getting into the new tent, but that was impossible now.
Can you imagine what he's going to do once he realizes the ring and the locket are gone? What if he moves the Hogwarts Horcrux, decides it isn't safe enough? But how are we going to get in?
We'll go to Hogsmeade, said Harry, and try to work something out once we see what the protection around the school's like.
Get under the cloak, Hermione. I want to stick together this time. But we don't really fit. It'll be dark. No one's going to notice our feet.
The flapping of enormous wings echoed across the black water. The dragon had drunk its fill and risen into the air. They paused in their preparations to watch it climb higher and higher, now black against the rapidly darkening sky, until it vanished over a nearby mountain. Then Hermione walked forward and took her place between the other two. Harry pulled the cloak down as far as it would go, and together they turned on the spot into the crushing darkness. Chapter 28 The Missing Mirror. Harry's feet touched road. He saw the achingly familiar Hogsmeade High Street, dark shopfronts, and the outline of black mountains beyond the village, and the curve in the road ahead that led off toward Hogwarts, and lights spilling from the windows of the Three Broomsticks. And with a lurch of the heart, he remembered with piercing accuracy how he had landed here nearly a year before, supporting a desperately weak Dumbledore. All this in a second upon landing, and then, even as he relaxed his grip upon Ron's and Hermione's arms, it happened. The air was rent by a scream that sounded like Voldemort's when he had realized the cup had been stolen. It tore at every nerve in Harry's body, and he knew immediately that their appearance had caused it. Even as he looked at the other two beneath the cloak, the door of the Three Broomsticks burst open, and a dozen cloaked and hooded Death Eaters dashed into the street, their wands aloft. Harry seized Ron's wrist as he raised his wand. There were too many of them to stun. Even attempting it would give away their position. One of the Death Eaters waved his wand, and the scream stopped, still echoing around the distant mountains.
"A seal cloak!"
roared one of the Death Eaters. Harry seized its folds, but it made no attempt to escape. The summoning charm had not worked on it.
"Not under your wrapper, then, Potter!"
yelled the Death Eater, who had tried the charm, and then to his fellows,
"Spread out! He's here!"
Six of the Death Eaters ran toward them. Harry, Ron, and Hermione backed as quickly as possible down the nearest side street, and the Death Eaters missed them by inches. They waited in the darkness, listening to the footsteps running up and down, beams of light flying along the street from the Death Eaters' searching wands.
"Let's just leave," Hermione whispered. "Disapparate now."
"Great idea," said Ron. But before Harry could reply, a Death Eater shouted,
"We know you're here, Potter, and there's no getting away. We'll find you."
"They were ready for us," whispered Harry. "They set up that spell to tell them we'd come. I reckon they've done something to keep us here. Trap us."
"What about you, Dementors?"
called another Death Eater.
"Let them have free rein. They'd find him quick enough. The Dark Lord wants Potter dead by no hand but his.
And Dementors won't kill him. The Dark Lord wants Potter's life, not his soul. He'll be easier to kill if he's been kissed first."
There were noises of agreement. Dread filled Harry. To repel Dementors, they would have to produce Patronuses, which would give them away immediately.
"We're going to have to try to disapparate, Harry," Hermione whispered.
Even as she said it, he felt the unnatural cold begin to steal over the street. Light was sucked from the environment, right up to the stars, which vanished. In the pitch blackness, he felt Hermione take hold of his arm, and together they turned on the spot. The air through which they needed to move seemed to have become solid. They could not disapparate. The Death Eaters had cast their charms well. The cold was biting deeper and deeper into Harry's flesh. He, Ron, and Hermione retreated down the side street, groping their way along the wall, trying not to make a sound. Then, around the corner, gliding noiselessly, came Dementors, 10 or more of them, visible because they were of a denser darkness than their surroundings, with their black cloaks and their scabbed and rotting hands. Could they sense fear in the vicinity? Harry was sure of it. They seemed to be coming more quickly now, taking those dragging, rattling breaths he detested, tasting despair on the air, closing in. He raised his wand. He could not, would not suffer the Dementor's kiss, whatever happened afterward. It was of Ron and Hermione that he thought as he whispered, "Expecto Patronum!" The silver stag burst from his wand and charged. The Dementors scattered, and there was a triumphant yell from somewhere out of sight.
"It's him! Down there! Down there! I saw his Patronus! It was a stag!"
The Dementors had retreated. The stars were popping out again, and the footsteps of the Death Eaters were becoming louder. But before Harry in his panic could decide what to do, there was a grinding of bolts nearby. A door opened on the left-hand side of the narrow street, and a rough voice said,
"Potter! In here! Quick!"
He obeyed without hesitation. The three of them hurtled through the open doorway.
"Upstairs! Keep the cloak on! Keep quiet!"
muttered a tall figure, passing them on his way into the street and slamming the door behind him. Harry had had no idea where they were, but now he saw, by the stuttering light of a single candle, the grubby, sawdust-strewn bar of the Hogshead Inn. They ran behind the counter and through a second doorway which led to a rickety wooden staircase that they climbed as fast as they could. The stairs opened onto a sitting room with a threadbare carpet and a small fireplace, above which hung a single large oil painting of a blonde girl who gazed out at the room with a kind of vacant sweetness. Shouts reached them from the street below. Still wearing the invisibility cloak, they crept toward the grimy window and looked down. Their saviour, whom Harry now recognized as the Hogshead's barman, was the only person not wearing a hood.
"So what?"
he was bellowing into one of the hooded faces.
"So what? You send Dementors down my street? I'll send a Patronus back at 'em. I'm not having him near me, I've told you that. I'm not having it."
"That wasn't your Patronus," said a Death Eater.
"That was a stag. It was Potter's."
"Stag?"
roared the barman, and he pulled out a wand.
"Stag? You idiot. Expecto Patronum."
Something huge and horned erupted from the wand. Head down, it charged toward the high street and out of sight.
"That's not what I saw,"
said the Death Eater, though with less certainty.
"Curfew's been broken. You heard the noise,"
one of his companions told the barman.
"Someone was out in the street against regulations. If I want to put my cat out, I will, and be damned to your curfew." "You set off the caterwauling charm?"
"What if I did? Going to cart me off to Azkaban? Kill me for sticking my nose out my own front door? Do it, then, if you want to. But I hope for your sake you haven't pressed your little dark marks and summoned him. He's not going to like being called here for me and my old cat, is he now?"
"Don't you worry about us," said one of the Death Eaters.
"Worry about yourself, breaking curfew. And where will you lot traffic potions and poisons when my pubs close down? What'll happen to your little sidelines, then?"
"Are you threatening?"
"I keep my mouth shut. It's why you come here, isn't it?" "I still say I saw a stag Patronus,"
shouted the first Death Eater.
"Stag?"
roared the barman.
"It's a goat, idiot."
"All right, we made a mistake," said the second Death Eater. "Break curfew again, and we won't be so lenient."
The Death Eaters strode back toward the high street. Hermione moaned with relief, wove out from under the cloak, and sat down on a wobble-legged chair. Harry drew the curtains tight shut, then pulled the cloak off himself and Ron. They could hear the barman down below, rebolting the door of the bar, then climbing the stairs. Harry's attention was caught by something on the mantelpiece, a small rectangular mirror propped on top of it, right beneath the portrait of the girl. The barman entered the room.
"You bloody fools,"
he said gruffly, looking from one to the other of them.
"What were you thinking, coming here?"
"Thank you," said Harry. "We can't thank you enough. You saved our lives." The barman grunted. Harry approached him, looking up into the face, trying to see past the long, stringy, wire-grey hair and beard. He wore spectacles. Behind the dirty lenses, the eyes were a piercing, brilliant blue.
It's your eye I've been seeing in the mirror.
There was silence in the room. Harry and the barman looked at each other.
You sent Dobby?
The barman nodded and looked around for the elf.
Thought he'd be with you. Where have you left him?
He's dead, said Harry. Bellatrix Lestrange killed him. The barman's face was impassive. After a few moments he said,
I'm sorry to hear it. I like that elf.
He turned away, lighting lamps with prods of his wand, not looking at any of them.
You're Aberforth, said Harry to the man's back.
He neither confirmed nor denied it, but bent to light the fire.
How did you get this?
Harry asked, walking across to Sirius's mirror, the twin of the one he had broken nearly 2 years before.
Bought it from Dung about a year ago, said Aberforth. Albus told me what it was. Been trying to keep an eye out for you.
Ron gasped.
The Silver Doe, he said excitedly. Was that you, too? What are you talking about? Said Aberforth. Someone sent a doe Patronus to us. Brains like that, you could be a Death Eater, son. Haven't I just proved my Patronus is a goat?
Oh, said Ron.
Yeah. Well, I'm hungry,
he added defensively as his stomach gave an enormous rumble.
I got food, said Aberforth,
and he sloped out of the room, reappearing moments later with a large loaf of bread, some cheese, and a pewter jug of mead, which he set upon a small table in front of the fire. Ravenous, they ate and drank, and for a while there was silence but for the crackle of the fire, the clink of goblets, and the sound of chewing.
Right then, said Aberforth, when they had eaten their fill, and Harry and Ron sat slumped dozily in their chairs. We need to think of the best way to get you out of here. Can't be done by night. You heard what happens if anyone moves outdoors during darkness. Caterwauling charms set off. They'll be on to you like bow truckles on doxy eggs. I don't reckon I'll be able to pass off a stag as a goat a second time. Wait for daybreak when curfew lifts. Then you can put your cloak back on and set out on foot. Get right out of Hogsmeade, up into the mountains, and you'll be able to disapparate there. Might see Hagrid. He's been hiding in a cave up there with Grawp ever since they tried to arrest him.
We're not leaving, said Harry. We need to get into Hogwarts.
Don't be stupid, boy, said Aberforth.
We've got to, said Harry.
What you've got to do, said Aberforth, leaning forward, is to get as far from here as you can.
You don't understand. There isn't much time. We've got to get into the castle. Your brother, wanted us... The firelight made the grimy lenses of Aberforth's glasses momentarily opaque, a bright, flat white, and Harry remembered the blind eyes of the giant spider, Aragog.
My brother Albus wanted a lot of things, said Aberforth, and people had a habit of getting hurt while he was carrying out his grand plans. You get away from this school, Potter, and out of the country if you can. Forget my brother and his clever schemes. He's gone where none of this can hurt him, and you don't owe him anything.
You don't understand, said Harry again.
Oh, don't I? Said Aberforth quietly. You don't think I understood my own brother? Think you knew Albus better than I did?
I didn't mean that, said Harry, whose brain felt sluggish with exhaustion and from the surfeit of food and wine.
He left me a job. Did he now? Said Aberforth. Nice job, I hope. Pleasant, easy. Sort of thing you'd expect an unqualified wizard kid to be able to do without overstretching themselves.
Ron gave a rather grim laugh. Hermione was looking strained.
It's not easy, no, said Harry, but I've got to... Got to? Why got to? He's dead, isn't he?
Said Aberforth roughly.
Let it go, boy, before you follow him. Save yourself.
I can't.
Why not?
Harry felt overwhelmed. He could not explain, so he took the offensive instead.
But you're fighting, too. You're in the Order of the Phoenix.
I was, said Aberforth.
The Order of the Phoenix is finished. You know who's won. It's over. And anyone who's pretending difference, kidding themselves. It'll never be.